Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today we begin our series on homelessness in Michigan. Just what are our misconceptions about those who don't have a roof over their heads? And what does homelessness say about us as a society? Also on today's show, we look at what Michigan cities could learn from the rebuilding of New Orleans. But first, Sandy Hook Elementary School, a name that is now burned into history, the history of senseless violence in the United States. As the nation mourns the 20 young students and 6 teachers and school administrators killed Friday in the Connecticut grade school mass shooting, attention here in Michigan has been freshly focused on a law that was passed less than 24 hours before the Sandy Hook massacre. One of the last acts of the lame duck legislature was to pass a bill that allows those with concealed pistol licenses to carry guns into schools, daycare centers, hospitals, churches, stadiums, and bars. Governor Snyder now has to consider whether to sign or veto this legislation.
It was just a terrible tragedy in Connecticut. Our thoughts and prayers go out to everyone there. I know everyone around the nation feels that way, and it does give you real pause about whether what's in this bill would be appropriate or not.
Joining us now is Michigan Public Radio Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. So, Rick, help us understand this. Even before this legislation, what did Michigan have in the form of gun regulations? Maybe we should start by outlining the difference between open carry and concealed carry.
Sure. Well, right now, Michigan is what's called an open carry state that if you don't need a license or anything like that, that if you are in a public space, that you can sling your rifle over your shoulder, you can put a holster on as long as it's outside of your clothing and openly carry. One of the places that applies apparently is schools. Very few people do it, but it is apparently the law. So one of the trade-offs in this legislation would be that schools would no longer be open carry areas, but they would be someplace where you could carry a concealed pistol if you go in for more classroom training and have more range time, that you would then be allowed to go and carry into these other places, schools, daycares, hospitals, with a concealed pistol license.
So proponents of this bill seem to argue, well, this actually restricts the possibility that guns could be carried into a school or the like. Here's Senator Rick Jones of the 24th District, because we talked to him about Senate Bill 59 and also whether some group could or could not opt out of allowing guns in. Here's what he said.
What this bill does is, first place, is you will not be able to open carry into these zones anymore. That will be banned. The only people that will be able to carry into these zones would be either be a retired police officer in good standing or a citizen with additional enhanced training. And in addition to that, a business, a school, a church could simply post a sign that said guns are not allowed, and then no one would be able to legally enter those places. So this is a new restriction in Michigan law, and I don't believe the media has correctly reported this in some cases.
So, Rick, from what you've done in studying the law, how accurate is this statement?
Well, somewhat, but not entirely accurate. And keep in mind, we are still sorting through this 80-page bill and trying to find out what's in it. But I have read it. Earlier versions of it did include apparently language that would have allowed a school to post as a no-gun zone, just as it could today. It is not in the version of Senate Bill 59 that's in front of the governor. It does allow for the operators of private buildings, and a church would count as a private building, to post as a no carry zone. That there's language in it that says that universities, with their autonomy in the state constitution, would be able to enact their own campus gun ordinances. But it's murky at best as to, you know, what schools would be allowed to do. In terms of whether or not it's more restrictive, I mean, that's kind of a subjective statement, that you could argue that certainly that getting rid of open carry is more restrictive, but is it more restrictive as a practical matter? Very few people do it.
I want to talk about the politics of the situation that Governor Rick Snyder is in right now. Apparently, you know, he's been officially neutral as the legislation made its way through the state legislature, and now we have Sandy Hook. So did the governor go through some negotiations with the bill's sponsor, Senator Mike Green, and is he now expecting the governor to sign?
Well, there were. And as a matter of fact, the original point of controversy on this package, and it wasn't even in this particular piece of legislation, was whether or not the state was going to continue to have a registry of pistol owners that gun rights advocates wanted the state to get rid of it. They don't like the idea of the government actually having lists of people who have firearms. But the Michigan State Police came in and said, you know, we use this to solve crimes, that they use the registered the pistol registry, for example, just to name one, to track down the I-96 shooter. So that was originally, you know, there were a whole lot of negotiations. Even this legislation, this point was. You know, at the outset, kind of a minor part of it, that this is actually part of a bill that would get rid of county gun boards that are made up of prosecutors and clerks and sheriffs. And it says that because Michigan is what's called a shall issue state, that these local gun boards can't deny applications for concealed weapons permits unless they've got a specific reason that's outlined in the law for denying it. And this was all, you know, done based on that. My understanding is that the governor did press for including schools as gun-free zones, or at least legally gun-free zones, in this legislation, and he was turned down.
So where does he sit now, in your view? What, first of all, what price would Governor Snyder pay politically if he vetoes the legislation?
Well, the phone calls, web messages, emails coming in to the governor by, if I'm counting correctly, and there are thousands of them, people who want him to veto the legislation, they're outnumbering the people who are supporting it by about 5-1. And that's out of, something north of 6,000 contacts that have come into the governor's office so far. So, you know, one would get the sense that the public at large certainly would like to see this particular piece of legislation go away. But, you know, he is an elected Republican who has said he would like to serve a second term, and he's got to think about his party's base and what that means in terms of reelection. Now, those are very, you know, crass political calculations that probably aren't as prominent in many respects as they would on a lot of other questions that aren't as sensitive as this, just considering, you know, how horrible it was, how recent it was.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks for talking with us today, Rick.
Oh, you bet, Cindy.
Meanwhile, earlier today, Governor Snyder asked his administration for a fresh review of school security policies in Michigan, along with mental health and gun policies. The governor says he has concerns about Senate Bill 59 as he reviews the bill and decides whether to approve or veto it. That, he says, led him to ask for a review of school security, mental health, and gun policies in Michigan and see what more can be done to better protect our children. The shock in the aftermath of Friday's mass shootings at that Connecticut grade school reminded some of our listeners of another horrific tragedy many, many years ago right here in our state. Many folks emailed wanting a remembrance of what happened 85 years ago in Bath, Michigan. On May 18, 1927, the small town of Bath, about 10 miles from Lansing, was forever changed when 55-year-old Andrew Kehoe set off a collection of explosives that were concealed in the basement of the local school. On that day, 38 children and 6 adults were killed. Among them was Kehoe himself. Police then discover Kehoe had murdered his wife, Nellie, and set his home and property on fire. So as we mourn the loss of lives in Connecticut, we also take this time to remember the victims of the Bath Massacre. We would love to hear your thoughts on all of this. We'd love to hear from you here at Stateside. It's easy to find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, we'll kick off our series exploring the misconceptions people have about the homeless. And writer Mickey Maynard is back from New Orleans, and she's got some ideas about what Detroit can learn from the Big Easy. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The homeless. It's a term that's used very freely in news reports and academic treatments and papers and social welfare agency reports. And as much as it is a good thing to support and initiate efforts to help out and care about the men, women, and children who don't have a place to call home, there can be a danger in that term, the homeless. It can put a convenient label on those people, one that can lead to a greater divide between those who have and those who have not. Michigan Radio News reporter Kyle Norris wanted to look closely at the homeless people in the streets of Detroit and discover small but important ways that people are helping the homeless, stories and lessons that can be found on the streets of many cities throughout Michigan. So Kyle Norris is here with us on Stateside, and she's joined by Megan Takashima, who's with the Corporation for Supportive Housing. It's a national nonprofit dedicated to ending homelessness by setting up permanent supportive housing. Welcome to both of you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Kyle, I want to start with you. We're going to be presenting a series of your reports, and you really went out on the streets focusing on who is homeless and how people are helping. What prompted you to want to just undertake this and pull this series together?
I did not plan this at all. We got the source for the first story, which is this mobile medical clinic through PIN. So someone contacted us and said, hey, we're doing this in Detroit. Come check it out. And I jumped on. I was like, this is amazing. But I think certainly something is drawing me to these stories. I'm compelled. I guess I want to know who these people are and what their stories are. And I don't think I hear about that in the news. So I want to tell those stories. You know, the other thing is when I'm with homeless people, I have to be real. I don't know, you know, Megan, if you experienced this, but there's kind of no BS. It's very real. I have to be a human first, a reporter second. And I love that.
Why? Why do you have to be?
What being alive is about, being humans together and sort of knowing that experience. And it pushes me to do my best work, and it pushes me into uncomfortable situations. You know, when I was on the streets of Detroit, I'd never done anything like that. And like, go behind the liquor store and talk to some homeless folks. Mm-hmm. I'd never done that. And it was scary and intense. So, because it pushes me.
Mm-hmm. And Megan, your work with the homeless has been going on for many, many years. Give us a sense, if you can, about how many people are estimated to be homeless in the city of Detroit.
Well, the estimate is about 19,000 individuals who were counted in a system called HMIS, which is the Homeless Management Information System. So these are any people that sought help assistance because of homelessness or risk of homelessness during 2011.
Give us an idea, if you can, just who these people are. And we're certainly talking about families, and we're talking about little children. Give us a sense of that.
Well, so I think, And I don't want to say that there are only two groups of people who are homeless, but a lot of times you have families or individuals who are down on their luck. Maybe they've lost their job. Maybe their unemployment has run out and housing is no longer affordable for them. So they're at risk of losing their housing. And then I think you have a group of generally what we call the chronic homeless individuals. Mm-hmm. Individuals have been homeless for a long time on end, have spent, you know, numerous nights in a shelter, maybe more than a year. And those folks generally have more challenging difficulties in addition to their homelessness. So those may be individuals who have substance use disorders or mental illness or, you know, significant physical disabilities or some combination of the three. And treating them and getting them into housing and keeping them to housing is more challenging.
I vividly remember in the early 90s when there were great cuts in benefits, and also when the hospitals, the hospitals to care for the mentally ill closed. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of talk about the safety net springing holes and people slipping through. What's the state of the safety net today in 2012?
Well, I think we still face a lot of the same challenges. I think, you know, particularly as you mentioned, for people who have a severe and persistent mental illness, it's very challenging for folks who even have some income coming in through Social Security benefits to keep housing, both because it's unaffordable. Mm-hmm. The standard Social Security benefit for someone who receives Social Security insurance or SSI is about $700 a month. So that's not a lot to work with when you're trying to obtain housing. And then the other challenge is that for people who have been homeless for a long time, they need services, and they need services in their home in order to be able to maintain their housing. So without an access to subsidized housing and the services to stay successful in housing, they're oftentimes returned to the street or they're not able to secure housing on their own.
I want you both to answer this question. I'll start with you, Kyle, because I can tell this was really an important experience for you personally, being out walking the streets, talking to people, really getting to know them. What do you think now, looking back, having worked on these stories, are the biggest misconceptions that the Habs have about the homeless?
Oh, that they're dumb, that they're stupid people. Every time I meet homeless people, they are smart. They're very funny. There's like a wicked sense of humor. The guys and the woman I was hanging out with the other day in the mobile medical clinic were just cracking jokes. And huge generalization, I find homeless people listen to the news. Those guys told me the top news stories in Detroit. They told me news reporters' names. They followed stuff. They were very bright. They were very smart. You know, when I asked, one of the guys had sort of his life philosophy, and I was like, what did you study in school? You know, kind of threw that out there. And he's like, well, I didn't finish high school, you know, but I wanted to study like philosophy. And you could see that sort of in him. So I think that's the biggest misconception.
And Megan, in your work, how would you answer that question?
Wow, that's a tough question. I think there's a lot of misconceptions. But generally, I think I would echo what Kyle says in that this is a group of people that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe don't have access to the things that you and I have, but they're not that different than you and me. Mm-hmm. And really all they're looking for is to be treated like anyone else.
I would get the sense, and having done some reporting in the past and kind of similar stories to what Kyle had done, that when we talk about the haves and the have-nots, that gap is not such a big gap. And I dare say for many people listening who have a home and have a job, it's a very slippery slope, and it doesn't take much in the terms of paychecks lost and suddenly income goes away, where suddenly that slope is very slippery and you're sliding down and you can't get back up. Is that true? I mean, as far as that sense of the gulf is not as large as people might want to think.
I think it is true. And I think, you know, what we saw during the last few years when Michigan was really struggling economically is that we saw a greater number of people who were homeless or at risk of homelessness just because, you know, the access to employment was no longer there. A lot of people were laid off. So you saw people that, you know, maybe had a comfortable middle class life, mm-hmm. who are now facing homelessness just because they didn't have the funds to make ends meet.
Kyle, I want to ask you about your first story. You wrote along with this team of students from Wayne's Med School. What was that like?
It was intense, and it was also really fun. Like, it was just really fun. The young med students were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I mean, they were, like, alive and really present. And they worked with a nurse practitioner from a homeless center. And so he was sort of guiding them. But we hopped in this van, and we rumbled down Michigan Avenue, and we were like, looking for homeless people. Mm. And we would pull over and ask people, like, how you doing? Like, do you need anything? Like, we have some medical people. Can we give you a checkup? Do you need a health kit? And I have never done anything like that as a reporter or just in my life. It was wild.
So give me an idea of some of the people you met.
Well, we met three people behind a dumpster. They had their tent right on I-94, and that's where they lived. The med team tried to approach a young prostitute on the corner. She had to be early 20s, and she said she did want some services, but then she had to leave with a John. You know, so that was – I've never been around that. That stuck with me. That was really intense. They tried to grab another guy, and you know, and they're always saying, hey, we have, you know, medical people here for free, you know. And the guy said, you know what, I'm dying. I'm going to die soon anyways. My medicine costs – you know, $500 a bottle. Why? And he walked away. You know, you kind of come up against that, too.
Megan, I'd like your thoughts, if I could. Can you compare and contrast the experience of being homeless throughout Michigan? Because certainly it's not a problem confined to Detroit. Mm-hmm. You can find homeless people in Ann Arbor. You can go to Traverse City. Can you compare and contrast the experiences?
Well, I think, you know, there's the urban experience, and of course that varies from place to place. An urban Ann Arbor experience might be different than one in Detroit. And then you have a rural experience where mm-hmm. folks are very far from, you know, available shelters, or there's not a shelter in that area. So
what would they do?
So for people who are homeless in those areas, there's a coordinated system of care through the different counties, and it's mm-hmm. sort of a complicated process to describe that. Yeah. But essentially, if shelters aren't available, they're able to produce funds to keep people in hotels until they're able to assess their situation and try to get them into housing. But yeah, the challenges are definitely different. I mean, for example, there's a high vacancy rate in apartments in Detroit. So it's not that hard to find an apartment for a person. It's really piecing together the finances. While in the rural communities, you may find, you know, more NIMBYism. We don't want these folks in our community, or the challenges of just finding suitable housing because there's not as much available housing stock.
Let's talk about the little picture sense. And mm-hmm. I bet you've got some insights now that you've had your mind open, Kyle, by your experience. What do you think we as individuals can do to help with this problem in our communities?
Well, you know, that all three of my stories sort of focus on that. They have like an individual doing this mm-hmm. tiny little thing that is making maybe a small difference. But that's, I don't know, that's kind of the way I wrap my head around it. I guess my sort of thought is find a way that's sort of true to who you are to do your little thing to help. Like one of the women in my stories, she's an interior designer, and she remakes a homeless shelter. She sort of revamps them and reorganizes mm-hmm. them, does a home makeover sort of, and that's her thing. You know, maybe your thing is showing up to a soup kitchen, or maybe it's something totally different, not directly involved. Like, find your tiny way that's true to you that can be of service.
Megan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a challenging one because oftentimes, you know, particularly in Detroit, you'll see people on street corners mm-hmm. asking for money, and you don't know if they're homeless. You don't know what they're going to do with the money and if it's really going to help. What I would say is do some research on the organizations that are helping people who are homeless in your community, and either consider donating your time or your money to help those organizations that you know are doing the work successfully.
I'm going to end with you, Kyle, with wondering aloud, what do you hope our Michigan radio listeners are going to take away from your series?
I just hope they listen with open ears. I guess I can't say what they'll you know, what effect they'll have or what they'll feel, but just listen.
Listen. And the first of Kyle Norris's three stories will be running tomorrow on Stateside. Kyle Norris, Michigan Radio News, and Megan Takashima of the Corporation for Supportive Housing. Thanks for joining us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This is certainly the time of year that many of us are scrambling to buy gifts. So here's a question. As you're standing at the checkout line, how often do you use cash to buy those gifts? It seems these days most of us just whip out the plastic when we're at a store or shopping online. I know I was doing some holiday shopping yesterday, and I pulled out some bills from my wallet instead of the trusty credit card, and it seemed unusual to be counting out cash for the presents I was buying. So it got us wondering, what would America look like if we got rid of coins and bills? Well, let's put that question to someone who's been closely studying the pros and cons of digital paperless money. Miles Kimball is a professor of economics and survey research at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you.
So, Miles, what would America look like if I was not reaching into my wallet and counting out tens and fives and handing over cash?
Well, I think the key thing I'd like to emphasize is that you could actually keep the cash around and get a lot of the benefits if we just said that the electronic dollars were the real dollars and the paper dollars were just an ancillary thing. They were kind of a subordinate, subsidiary thing. And the thing you want to do is make it so that we can stimulate the economy with monetary policy. So a lot of people don't realize that the reason we've had such a long recession is because the Federal Reserve was not able to lower the interest rate because of the way our system uses paper money.
Okay. And why is that?
Well, basically, if you tried to make the interest rate be negative so that the money would actually shrink over time, which would actually be what's needed to stimulate the economy.
Okay.
Then people would say, oh, I'll just keep a big pile of cash. I'll keep
money under the mattress.
Exactly. Yeah, money under the mattress. And because of that, the Federal Reserve is not able to lower the interest rate low enough to get the economy moving again.
Okay. So there's this big, turgid, sluggish amount of cash that is sitting there. It's not being used in
that
sense. It would be.
I mean, the Federal Reserve doesn't even try to lower the interest rates because it knows that that would happen.
Explain a little more why being able to use electronic money, let's say my smartphone or my credit card, would stimulate the economy. How would that differ?
It just takes that limitation away from the Federal Reserve. And it's a big deal. When economists talk about it, they have a name for it. They call it the zero lower bound, and they actually talk about it a lot because it's a big, big problem. People may not realize it, but it's not just recessions that are a result of this limitation on what the Fed can do. It's also inflation because the Federal Reserve, because it's worried about its ability to make interest rates low enough, feels it needs to have a little bit of inflation. If you took that away, if you took away that zero lower bound so you could have negative interest rates, then we could also have an economy without inflation and still be able to take care of recessions.
So I've read where you actually would like to see the government issue a credit card. Here you are. Here's your government issue credit card. Talk about that a little more.
Well, so that's a different proposal, and
okay.
I think in some ways that's a less radical proposal. We quite often have tax rebates when there's a recession where you mail everybody a check and maybe $200. And the idea is simply we could make that a much larger amount of money if instead of just sending people a check, you asked people to pay it back. So instead of $200 per person as a tax rebate, you could have 10 times as much. You could have a $2,000 per person, $4,000 for a couple. And to use that would then stimulate the economy because people could go out, they could make a down payment on a car, they could go out and buy some appliances. There are a lot of things that people could and would do if they had money available to them that they could borrow at a good interest rate like that from the government.
When do you believe our country will be digital money?
Well, it certainly gets easier with every passing year as more and more of what we do is with electronic money as it is. I think the key thing is once one country does it, I think a lot of other countries will start doing it. I think actually it's probably easier to do in some place like England that has a parliamentary democracy and they have one party controlling all the levers of power than here in the United States. So I think it's more likely that some other country will do it first. But once some other country does it, they'll get just such a big advantage. It'll mean their economy will hum along and do great. And other countries will say, wait a minute, not only are people investing and consuming a lot in your economy? You're also exporting a lot. And they say, well, you should go to making the electronic money the real thing too.
I want to jump on that horse and ride it as well.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Miles Kimball is a professor of economics and survey research at the University of Michigan, talking with us today on Stateside. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, writer Mickey Maynard is back from New Orleans. and she thinks there are quite a few things that Detroit can learn from the rebirth of the Big Easy. We'll speak with Mickey coming up next, right here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was 2005 when Hurricane Katrina smashed its way onto the Gulf Coast. Few of us can forget the scenes of complete devastation and loss, especially in the city of New Orleans. In the 7 years since that terrible destruction, New Orleans has been in the process of recovering and rebuilding. Writer and contributor to Gadling.com, Mickey Maynard has been watching that recovery, and it's occurred to her there have been lessons learned in rebuilding New Orleans that could be applied to the city of Detroit. So, Mickey, what caused you to draw the connection between the Katrina damage in NOLA and what's happening in the city of Detroit?
Many people think that what happened in Detroit is the equivalent of an economic storm. So Katrina swept through New Orleans and did incredible destruction very quickly. Detroit's been feeling this over the last literally 50 years. But you have two cities that were brought to their knees. New Orleans, it's 7 years since the storm. The rebuilding is not over. But there's an interesting thing going on there in that you have people coming into the city from who are not New Orleanians, who see potential in New Orleans and who are now adding a layer to New Orleans that wasn't there before. Same thing is happening with Detroit. You now have a number of newcomers, many of them from other big cities, who see a lot of potential in Detroit and who are just starting to add a new flavor to Detroit, although I would say we have years to go yet.
So how is this being manifested in New Orleans? What are you seeing?
I did a series for a website called Gadling.com that looked at the new New Orleans. And what you see are a couple of things. First of all, these folks are taking what was there before but abandoned. So I did a story about a street in New Orleans called Ferret Street, which was actually a very lively street in the 30s and 40s. Jewish merchants, Italian merchants, basically the people who weren't part of old French society. Mm-hmm. And it was fine until the 50s, and then population trends came in. Then in the 70s, crime came in. In the 80s, there was a murder that basically sent everybody running from that commercial district. But after the storm, there was a shortage of places to do business. Mm-hmm. And as people were cleaning up, a few years later, they were looking for space. And one group of folks found an old firehouse and said, this would make a great artisanal cocktail bar. And people in the neighborhood said, what? You know, why would we want an artisanal cocktail bar? We could use, you know, other things.
Like a grocery store.
They opened this bar called Cure, and it is now on all the lists of the 50 best bars in America. And Cure was the sort of centerpiece that drew other investment to Ferret Street. And now you have a 7-block area full of restaurants, a little bit of retail, hardware store, paint store. It is now the hot street in New Orleans, and it started with a couple people believing they could turn a firehouse into a bar.
Well, it sounds like when you have something that forces you to hit the reset button, like Katrina, then you do throw out everything that was. And when you have people coming in with fresh eyes, a local probably wouldn't say, hey, let's take this old firehouse and turn it into an artisanal cocktail bar, but fresh eyes would.
The cool thing about what's going on in New Orleans is it's a mix of locals who do see the potential and these newcomers. Mm. And Joel Dondas, who is a restaurant owner, he's kind of like the Ari Wein swag at Zingerman's of New Orleans. He has started building a little restaurant empire that started with a catering business, but now he's got a patisserie, a coffee shop that opened right before the storm. He's got a brand new restaurant called Grand Isle right down in the middle of the tourist area, and one of those elegant little bistros called La Petite Grocery. Joel put this whole empire together. He's a local, but he saw saw that it was time to start new things. He said that essentially the storm was the wake-up call to New Orleans, that it couldn't just retreat into the past. It had to keep moving forward. So he's a local who kind of got the New Orleans bug.
And then does that start spreading like a positive virus, for lack of another way to put it? Does that get other people going, well, wait a minute. Yeah. He did it. What can we do?
That's a very good way to put it. What's happened down there is that you do have people from other places. So met a couple of other restaurant owners, one who's Israeli, one who came down from Memphis. They both helped out during the storm. They helped with the reclamation efforts. And they decided, you know what? I'm dedicated to this city. It's time to put down roots here. And it's time to open up a business and hire some people and make a difference. And so I don't know if it's a pioneering spirit, but I think it's a very American spirit of supporting when there is need and then seeing opportunity once the need has been filled.
Tell us some more about the new folks coming in, the ones who would be viewed as outsiders and they were not around before Katrina. Who are they and what are they doing?
One of the most interesting people that I met when I was there is a guy named Chip Apperson. And Chip owns a bar called The Hi Hat. It's actually a bar and grill on Ferret Street, the same street mm-hmm. where the bar's at the other end of the street. Chip and Hi Hat are at this end of the street. He and his wife owned restaurants in Memphis. They went down to New Orleans to help out during the storm. They then decided to buy a house and restore it. And after they restored the house, which took them a couple of years, they said, you know what? It's time to get back in the restaurant business. But up in Memphis, we did white tablecloth. We think we need a place where families, people from all incomes can come in, sit at the bar, get a homemade lemonade, get a cocktail. Of course, you have to have a cocktail in New Orleans. Get a meal, get fried chicken, get some pie, but not that old style candles and
stuffy
and yeah. silver. Because you still do have that in New Orleans, but it's essentially always going to be part of the culture. But this is, to me, this is the new New Orleans where, you know, come in at lunchtime. And I actually had, I think, 4 meals there in 5 days. It was just such a friendly and welcoming place.
And I get the feeling from what you're saying, maybe I'm reading between the lines, that the original folks, the folks that were there before Katrina, are welcoming of the outsiders?
You have to remember that New Orleans lost a vast amount of population.
Yeah.
The city, I was looking at some statistics comparing Hurricane Sandy and what happened with Katrina. And while Hurricane Sandy knocked out more people's electricity, Hurricane Katrina wiped out entire neighborhoods down there. And so mm-hmm. people came back to fix up the city, but there are people who didn't come back, who just said, you know what, I'm a musician and I was never treated right in the bars here. I'm going to play in Atlanta and Houston. So you had people who left and aren't coming back, but you have new folks coming in. And I think more than ever in its past, the old New Orleans is welcoming these new folks, because if they don't have them, then they're left with kind of a shell of what was there before. So it's woken everybody up. It's brought new ideas. I met Alon Shea, who is a chef in New Orleans, and he's, as I said, from Israel. He's adding Mediterranean touches to what's an Italian menu. He's kind of sneaking in things that would be very familiar to folks in Dearborn, but there's not a large Arab American population in New Orleans, so people are being introduced to Middle Eastern food that they don't know it, but this is what they're getting to eat.
Okay.
And so it's a kind of a food culture there that welcomes all these new ideas. And so he's going to teach people probably about the cuisine of the Middle East.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking with writer Mickey Maynard, who's done a series of stories for Gadling about the lessons learned in the rebuilding of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and what connections and lessons could be applied to the city of Detroit. So what can we take from that and put it onto the city of Detroit and its people?
I'm a big fan of the city of Detroit, and I have always thought there's so much potential in the city, but so much empty space, so mm-hmm. many empty buildings, so many neighborhoods that need services that just are not getting them because of the financial crisis. There's plenty of building stock in Detroit, and one of the parallels I would draw is between New Orleans Municipal Auditorium and the Michigan Central train station. Now,
okay.
If people watch the show on HBO called Treme, the Municipal Auditorium is that building where they want to put a jazz center, and it's all been caught up in politics. So the Municipal Auditorium is still empty, and I write about it in my series for Gadling that there's finally going to be some federal money where they can finally get in there. This is a place where they had all the Mardi Gras balls and ice skating shows, and they played basketball in there. Reopen it and fix it up and make it available to the community. If you look at what goes on with Michigan Central, we've all been saying for years, when is somebody going to get in there and put glass in the windows, put something in there, let's use it for a space. So there's a community effort to fix up the municipal auditorium. I think eventually we're going to see a community effort that focuses on Michigan Central as well.
You have to get it away from Maddie Maroon first.
That is a very important issue. And what's happened with the municipal auditorium in New Orleans is that it got caught up with the Nagin administration, mm-hmm. which wanted to do one thing with it. And now the new mayor has said, let's give this a try. So maybe we need some political leadership here that does the same thing. And obviously Detroit has many other problems than Michigan Central. But change is happening in New Orleans. Change can happen in Detroit as well.
How about the neighborhoods? How about where people are living? I know we've had guests on Stateside who have lived in the city, and we just had the author of the book Detroit City is the Place to Be, who actually lived in Eastern Market and bicycled and what went around the neighborhoods. And there is rebirth beginning. There's almost like these urban pioneers coming in. Are they being welcomed, do you think, by folks that have been living in those neighborhoods for years?
What's interesting about New Orleans is that you can drive down a block. So if you think about the neighborhood where Ferret Street is, it's mm-hmm. the uptown neighborhood. You drive around the blocks near that commercial district, you'll find brand new houses. You'll find empty boarded up houses. You'll find houses still under restoration since the storm. I think the most active thing in that neighborhood is really that paint store where people are coming in to fix up. So it's an ongoing process. And I think the longtime neighbors who've been able to fix up their houses are really glad to see this activity because it protects their home values. It means there's more activity. It means crime goes down. Crime is still a big problem in New Orleans, as it is a big problem in Detroit. But when you get the neighborhoods back, that's when you start to get groups of people that rally around commercial districts, rally around the bar, rally around the new bakery, and they will do their best to make that a viable neighborhood.
And Mickey, I suspect other cities as well, if you're talking Pontiac or Flint or Grand Rapids, parts that where there has been urban blight, for lack of another term, where there is area that needs rebuilding. So who would these people be that would come in? Who would be the equivalent of the French, of the chef from Memphis who decided to relocate and help rebuild New Orleans?
Well, never underestimate the power of the food industry to make something into attraction. And you think about Slo's Barbecue in Detroit, and a lot of people wouldn't go to Corktown except that Slo's is there. And now things are filling in Corktown. Sure. The same is true in the Midtown area, where you have places like the Avalon Bakery, where you have the crepe stores and other restaurants that have gone in there. So, I mean, first food, let's feed ourselves. I think the next thing that, especially in New Orleans, they'd say is retail, because you've had retail come in. Now they would like to have more grocery stores, which is certainly an issue that Detroit is facing. And in fact, you're starting to see more grocery stores. Wendell Pierce, who's one of the actors who appears on Treme, and he's familiar to NPR listeners, he is actually starting a small group of grocery stores with local sustainable food for neighborhoods in New Orleans that never had good grocery stores like that before. So you have to have the things that the neighborhood needs, but you also have to have the things that kind of are pleasing to the eye in a sense. One of the things about New Orleans is the way it looks. It's a beautiful city. The architecture is beautiful. Detroit's a rugged city. Detroit's an industrial city, but that's got its own aesthetic as well.
That's
and
true.
That's a very urban aesthetic. And a lot of people like the way that our buildings look. They like the brick. They like the old windows. They like the fact that you don't, it doesn't look like big box stores. It looks like an old city. And so that is appealing to people.
So what challenge would you put out to anyone listening to our conversation right now who feels that spark of entrepreneurship or frontier spirit?
Right. One of the things that I liked a lot about New Orleans is that People have a great love for the city of New Orleans. And I have to say, I've been there 3 times in the last year. And every time I'm there, I'm thinking, oh, they need to fix that and they need to fix this. And then I just sit back and go, I like it here. I just like the way people are. They talk to you. They're interested. They're looking at new ideas. I think with the city of Detroit, we have great opportunity with the newcomers to the city of Detroit. Now, hipsters come, artists come, people come because they see personal opportunity. I think primarily we wouldn't have folks here if they didn't think that this was going to help their daily lives and give them a sense of adventure or a new sense of opportunity. But at some point, you make a commitment to the community around you, and you don't just say, I'm here because my apartment's $300 a month and I can ride my bike anywhere. You have to look at what you're riding by on your bicycle. You have to look at what you're seeing out your window. That's the point where you make a commitment to your community. And what I've seen in New Orleans is person after person after person came because they wanted to be in New Orleans, and now they want to help New Orleans. And I'm seeing it at all age levels. I'm seeing it from young people who are giving $100 a month to these giving circles that make charitable donations, to these young chefs, to the entrepreneurs, to the older folks who've decided, you know what, I'm done in St. Louis or Memphis or Las Vegas. I want to live someplace where I really want to enjoy it. And so I think Detroit can offer that. We might not have the jazz clubs and the you know, being able to walk around at 3 in the morning with a cocktail. But there's a lot in Detroit that needs fixing. So that's an opportunity. And there's a lot of history in Detroit that's just as valuable to this country as the history in New Orleans. So I'm hoping that the newcomers to Detroit are now at that period where they're saying, you know what, I really like this. What more can I do for Detroit?
But certainly Detroit is very much at the very beginning. So there's kind of that – when you say people feel like they kind of really love that area in New Orleans, is that happening in Detroit? Are people saying, wow, I mean, except for maybe a small handful, are people coming in going, I love this. I really want to be here. Or are they saying, hey, I can get a place for $300 a month?
We're at the beginning of the spectrum. Mm. But one of the things that we have that they have in New Orleans is our folks are friendly, too.
Yeah.
This is a very warm community. This is a community where people lend a helping hand. So if you think about where New Orleans was in 2005, from 2005 to 2012 is 7 years. So it's just happening in New Orleans 7 years after the storm. We've just noticed the newcomers in, say, the last 2 years or so. So we're probably around 2007, which is where New Orleans was, and they were still dealing with the aftermath of the cleanup then. So we've got a ways to go. We need some economic help. We need focus, and we need commitment. And once those three things come together, those could very much plant the seeds for a Detroit that echoes what I've seen in New Orleans.
Mickey, always good to talk with you. Thanks for sharing with us today on Stateside.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Mickey Maynard is a writer and a contributor to Gadling.com. And we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts and your ideas for a city trying to rebuild? Let us know on Facebook at Stateside with Cynthia Canty, or go to Twitter, that's at Stateside Radio. And of course, you can find us on our webpage, michiganradio.org. And while you're there, catch up on all past shows you might have missed. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock.